You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Now, troll on in.
Okay, so we almost need to get Doc Fitch at his own parking stall here in our building because we have been so fortunate to be able to hang out with him for a while. And today it's going to be the same, but with a little bit of a different twist because I thought, and he didn't even know this yet, but we're going to talk about some of the things that are fun about what work is, and particularly how some of them have really, really important, far-reaching implications that sometimes if you didn't know that, it's hard to see the forest for the trees. Things get pretty boring, but I don't think that PhD Mark Fitch is a person that gets very bored, are you?
Nope.
For those that don't know, what circuitous route brought you to the council here in Hawaii?
What really got me here is I'd been always wanted to live in Hawaii, living on the East Coast, and been involved in fisheries and been interested in pelagic fisheries. I had a lot of friends who work over at Pacific Islands Fishery Science Center over at NOAA. Throughout the years, I've known them probably for about a decade, and then a job opened with the federal government in stock assessment. I worked there for a year, and then the position opened up to work on pelagic fisheries. So, like, I've done my PhD on billfish and had worked on stock assessment in the Atlantic, and so this was an interesting sort of a jack of all trades job that, that they wanted. They offered me the position, and so I now work with council. I've been there since for about 8 months now.
Yeah, and here's the thing that I've noticed, and I got a couple of comments about this from friends that listen, and that is, it says this guy sounds like he enjoys his work, and I got to tell you that I've learned that from you, and I think that there's probably many, many others like you that, you know. It's very few of us get to do what we want to do. And it sounded like you just got, you know, slowly but surely steered yourself into a job that you really wanted.
Yeah, and this is something it's kind of, it really is an ideal job for what I've been trained for. You know, being able to travel and work with a lot of other management agencies. And I enjoy the aspect of going off and speaking with folks of different cultures, of different backgrounds, traveling, seeing different points of view in fisheries management, because I think a lot of people have the misconception that if you get into marine biology, you're automatically going into advocacy, or you're just going to be working, sort of not working with the human aspect in fisheries.
Yeah, I was going to say, there to me, all of you guys that I talk to, There's two kind of basically differences. One of them is one of the ones that say the world is ending. You know, there's no fish. And the other guy says, no, we have a lot of fish. We just don't know where they all are. So that somewhere in between gets, and I'm not sure that the listener understands the far-reaching implications of the work that you all do in the scientific community as to who interprets what you've done, and then the decisions get made based on what you've determined, like stock assessments.
Right, and then you know you kind of hit it on the head right there. You know, folks who can interpret science may have an agenda. With fisheries here, you know, and as scientists, we're for the most part, we're trained pretty well to sort of be looking at fact-based decision-making. And especially in fisheries where you are managing not only a resource but people, but you're also looking at how to best utilize a fishery for a return on investment for long term.
Yeah, that ROI that everybody that has a boat. Right. But you know, there's another aspect of it, and that is here in Hawaii, we may have different reasons to need to know. But because if you want a sustainable industry, then you have to know that you don't overfish.
Right.
And I do know that the argument is up, but maybe from your standpoint as a PhD in this, you should be able to talk about not just how assessments are made, but maybe how much more accurate things may be. Case in point, right now as we're speaking, a couple of weeks ago was a whale count. And to me, that's pretty primitive. I mean, if you get guys sitting around, you know, different points of an island, it's pretty primitive. But it's turned out to be sometimes pretty accurate. You know, so let's talk about the science that goes into the studies that you do now as to what makes a fish assessment valuable and accurate.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, so when you have data like counts or fish census, using a fish census or creel surveys or looking at logbooks or like we have in Hawaii, we have one of the most monitored pelagic fisheries.
I should say pretty well monitored.
Pretty well monitored where we have, where, and as Paul Dalzell, who used to work for council, who I still talk to and get some advice from, he was in my position for several years.
And by the way, if you're out there, Doc, how you doing, man? Miss you. He's a great, good, fun guy.
He is definitely a personality, and he's good to have around the office. Yeah. But Paul came up with this term regarding our tuna fisher here in Hawaii. Every pound can be found.
Yeah.
Meaning that we have
very good,
very good degree of compliance in all of our fisheries, anywhere from our non-commercial to our commercial fisheries. So it's important to monitor our data. And then you look at rates. So we look at catch rates to essentially come up with indices of abundance. Mm-hmm. And
That's the exact word I was looking for, indices of abundance. In other words, something to give you scientific, as much certainty as you can get, as this is kind of where this particular species is right now.
Right. And so you have different degrees of what I would call what's called CPUE, catch per unit effort. And so what that is how many fish you may catch per an hour, how many fish you may catch per hooks. It's all relative to the fishery or gear that you're using. We've worked, and I've done a lot of work on looking at small boat when I was in Costa Rica working
with
recreation.
Small boat, what's small boat?
Well, trollers. Mm-hmm. Small boat relative to some of the high seas, longliners, and purse seiners. So every fishery and every fishing vessel has its own nuances on how you estimate catch per unit effort, and then from that you derive what an index of abundance. And how we tease this out statistically is you look at how changes may occur relative to, let's say, one point to another. So you have a trend. And oftentimes people will see a declining catch per unit effort and say, uh-oh, the fishery's in trouble.
Yeah.
And there can be a lot of
wait.
there can be a lot of things at play, especially when you're dealing with non-target species. So if you have let's say we're looking at a certain species that's caught incidentally in, say, a tuna fishery. Mm-hmm. Well, there could have been operational changes in that fishery. Yeah. So maybe they're setting their hooks deeper. Maybe so if you're looking at, for example, I'm just going to throw one out. If you're looking to look at billfish, for example, billfish are caught as not as bycatch, but as an incidental catch. So and tuna
it used to be bycatch, but then they found a market.
They do.
I mean, you know, so the reason why it is that we're talking about this now is, and the last several shows we've been talking about this specifically, is that it's definitely part of the food system now, and it's a necessary thing. But by the same token, I don't know if we'd ever had real accurate assessments of stock before because there was no market value. Who looked at these things?
Well, we've had a time series here in Hawaii for roughly going on two and a half decades. Mm-hmm. And then the Japanese have kept records of how much fish they catch or of species per unit effort. But you haven't had a real directed fishery towards billfish. Here in Hawaii, we do. We have a troll fishery, which is pretty significant. It's very localized, but it's a hefty fishery. But, you know, for our long high seas fisheries that catch a decent number of billfish, those catch rates could be due in part to decline, but they also can be due to operational changes in the fishery.
Okay.
So you have to standardize for those.
Yeah, when you talked about catch, I think that the audience needs to know some of these things like effort. I do know that there have been really drastic changes in the measuring of that maybe you eliminate, say, travel time. You know, or you eliminate certain things that don't really have to do with the abundance or not abundance of that fish, because the guy might have come 200 miles to get to that hole and there was nobody there. But now you're saying that it only counts as when you're fishing or when the line's down.
Right. And so those operational changes could be, so for example, if you have to travel further, you know, maybe your actual effective fishing time is shorter. So if you have it a couple hours in a day, or you have X amount of fuel. So those spatial components need to be taken into
consideration.
Especially
for the small boats, right?
Because
they're limited fuel, particularly.
You know? Oh, yeah, fuel and costs a lot of money.
Yeah, you bet.
And so when you have closures sometimes, you know, closures can oftentimes force fisheries or fishermen to fish in areas outside of their range, of their normal range. There's more costs associated with that.
And dangers.
There is human peril.
Sure.
There is deferent, and that's something to be taken into consideration. There's cost to the product. So the fishery is a conduit from the resource to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So that could also translate into cost in the marketplace. And people here in Hawaii eat a lot of fish.
Yeah, I got to tell you something. And every time we get an expert to tell us this, it further validates what we have been saying for a long time. What Mark has noticed, and we've talked about it a few times, and I want to talk about it a little bit more, is that we are so dependent on this fishery. And I think that we've been, at least lately, and I don't know what your community thinks about it, but mine does, that the fishermen seem to be cooperating a little bit more because sometimes they've had an expected closure that became an opening, like right now it's going on, and some other things. But I think that maybe a long time ago, before the science of stock assessments that you're talking about, was that they weren't getting very much anecdotal stuff because the local fishermen didn't want to talk to the scientists at all.
And that's a ubiquitous issue. Mm-hmm. You know, where I'm from, back in North Carolina, mm-hmm. you know, there's a strong commercial fishing community, mm-hmm. small recreational, strong, actually a large recreational fishing community. So you can get people who get very cagey and yeah. a little bit of paranoia.
Yeah, that's a good word.
A little cagey. Bit of paranoia yeah. of the government yeah. or even those of scientists thinking mm-hmm. that they think because we have a PhD in the wall that right. we just want to go in and close stuff. And that's yeah. not always the case. You know, a lot of us, especially at council, a lot of us have been fishermen ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, our interest is to keep a resource that is important, you know, not only to us personally, but also to the community. And here's another big thing that I think a lot of people overlooked. We're the capital of the Pacific. We're at the juncture between the mainland U.S. and the Pan-Pacific Asian community.
Yep.
Fisheries is a global footprint of the United States economy and the Pacific. And it is an important component, not only for us. You know, there's different tiers of importance of fishery. You have the consumer, you have a cultural value, but you also have an economic and food security issue, especially in the Pacific Islands.
Yeah, and here, gang, is why this program sometimes deviates from who caught the biggest fish this last week at a tournament. Although we certainly do talk about that as we did a little earlier today. But one of the things that I think is important is that when you say that, when there's an economic opportunity, and here in the U.S., we have the wonderful way of marketing ourselves. We can get out there and let people know, swordfish from Hawaii, or whatever the thing is. This creates an opportunity from the other stakeholders in the area to also benefit from the pioneering and the business, the laying out of a business plan that's been done. So all they have to do is catch the fish. Somebody's going to come and get it and send it into a market, and they get money into their economy, which otherwise wouldn't have been there.
Yeah, and people also don't realize is that also good, strong economic fishing opportunities and good management manifest into not only, you know, sustainable, non-volatile fishing market, which is a big thing. You know, if you have a lot of volatility, that can also induce people to maybe target one species too hard and overfish it. So the good thing about here in Hawaii is we have a lot of species of fish. We have a lot of stocks. We have a lot of bottom fish stocks, a lot of pelagics. Mm-hmm. And some of them are in better shape than others.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a lot of stocks that are underutilized. And so being able to properly manage these, and so we come into some sense of equilibrium, we're actually able to get a good foothold on how much we can take.
What I like about that, Mark, is something that I hope the listeners can understand this. One of the things that you talk about is, and we talked a minute ago about pelagics, about bycatch and incidental catch. Now there's a couple of fish that a lot of people don't think of as pelagic that are, and that is, of course, the munchong. And the opa. Now, all of a sudden, look at the market that have been created for those two fish in the last couple of decades. They were just... Who even knew what they were before that? Because they were so rare. But now it looks like, hey, they're all over the place. If you know how to go find them, there's a big market here.
There is a big market here. The fishery, they're a bycatch species. No, actually, they're incidental. Sorry.
Yeah.
Incidental in the Big Eye tuna fishery. You know, Dave Itano put out a little newsletter article, I remember, a few years ago or a year or two ago, showing that on the seamounts, a lot of the longliners are actually trying to actually keep their hooks down lower and then able to increase
to get more
Munchong.
Yeah.
And that's good. Munchong is we're a unique place. There seems to be a high degree of abundance of the species. But you know, this is kind of where we go back to science and monitoring. You know, one of the things we're trying to do at council is get more information on Munchong, how much of a directed fishery there is towards Munchong, and so we can properly manage. Because if you over have a surplus of Munchong, as we've seen recently, not only can you maybe be hitting the resource hard, but also the price per pound
drops
goes way down.
Yeah. And you know, there's something interesting about that fish, and even more so about opah as we learn more and more of these things. But Munchong, it seems like when you go to the auction, the fish are all the same size. You know, I mean, goes to show you that if you get into an area where there's an abundance of that, that's what you get. In other words, you might get a big eye school, they're all 50 pounders. Or you might get a Munchong when they're all 10, but every one is 10.
Yeah, there's been some work done to show.
I don't get it.
Yeah, there's been some work done in the past. I think, I'm trying to remember if Secchi and Bigelow and those folks back in the 90s looked at the Pomfret. They're pretty, and I could be mistaken on which author that wrote on this, but there is a lot of they found that these fish grow rather quickly, mm-hmm. and are very prolific, and they reside in the deep water pelagic environment. But because they grow quickly, they reach that asymptotic length rather quickly,
right?
So you're going to have little variability, mm-hmm. but you could also in those size range, you could have a lot of age ranges.
Yeah, here's something kind of interesting. I'd love to talk about that some more, but I know for time it's going to be tough today. But I can tell you that we have developed a market for the fish that weren't marketable before. For instance, there are a lot of chefs across anywhere, especially in the Pacific, love Munchong. They say it travels well. It holds up pretty well. It'll take a variety. It's not so pungent that you can't, you know, make a lot of nice sauces and things that go with it. Isn't that just adding to the arsenal of restaurants and homeowners to have more fish variation in their diet?
Absolutely. And that's, it's funny, is like the Munchong, it keeps really well for a shockingly long time. People say it keeps one of the longest holding fish, which kind of surprised me.
When you look at it, you think
it's an ugly fish.
It's a pomfret. This is ugly, man. Who's going to
eat ugly
this?
It's ugly as hell.
Yeah.
It's like them and the Alphonsins is another deep water seamount associated fish. You know, that are kind of neat and colorful, but the pomfret is just this black, ugly.
You have this ugly fish.
It's so delicious.
You know, see, he put it right. Look, we don't have to have somebody that comes with a PhD to tell us that it's good, because it is really good. But there's another question that always comes up. And I know that we address this every now and again when we take a look at the bigger picture. But there's more and more people on the planet. And we're not certain that fish are increasing in population because they're not. Doesn't that tell us that there are certain species that we have to work on a little bit harder to be able to maybe raise them? Or that there are certain species that if we don't stop catching them for a while, they're going to be among the list of missing.
Right. And, you know, extirpation locally is an issue, especially in the developing world, where you have a very rapid increase in population and food demand. So there's a food supply issue, and fisheries does supply a large portion of the diet in Asia and Africa, and then parts of the South America, and especially in the Pacific Islands. So with human population increases, so does demand. But a recent article by, I think it was the FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, was showing that, you know, relatively speaking, 70% of fish production right now is from aquaculture.
Yeah, and by the way, there are more and more people saying, look, if you do it properly, the ocean is the biggest farm in the world, ever.
Right.
And maybe in the universe. Because, I mean, if you protect the water, the water will yield you a lot of stuff. So there's a lot, you know, that's why I think it's so interesting. By the way, if you're just joining us, Mark Fitchett is a PhD. He's a pelagic fisheries ecosystem scientist for the council. And some of the things that we're talking about, we need to get into this a little bit, is when we talk about the word abundance and stock assessments, all of those numbers, and you're working on some stuff right now that I think is really key for people to get, to maybe not understand every single thing we're talking about, but get sort of the big picture of why science is so interested in the fishery.
Right. And you know, one of the things that we're doing, so that project that we're working on right now, I'm working with a retired stock assessment scientist here in Hawaii, Bill Walsh. He worked at NOAA. Bill was over at PIFS for many years. Not to be confused, there's another Bill Walsh here. I think he's on the Big Island. But Bill Walsh, who are Bill Walsh, lives in Kailua. Great guy. Super knowledgeable. Dealt with the logbook system and observer data for years. And so we have this. We want to be able to use to build these abundance indicators for OPA, for Manchong, and for Hebi, a short-billed spearfish, which is my favorite fish, and Ono and Mahi. And so those five species, we're looking at catch records, catch pre-net effort, and we're trying to infer population trends through time. And kind of going on to some of the things that we talked earlier in the show. And so reason we're interested in this is because we don't have necessarily access to complete landings of Manchong or OPA, because OPA, there maybe not be reported in other fisheries outside the U.S. And also, the other thing about Manchong and OPA, which is interesting, is that we definitely have two species of Manchong, and we have at least five species of OPA, two of which are caught in the Hawaii fishery.
And that's the big surprise. Because unless you're the scientist, it's not that easy to differentiate. Now, we've talked about this before, yellowfin and bluefin. I mean, yellowfin and big eye. I mean, you have to be pretty trained to be able to tell the difference. But when you told us a couple programs ago about how many different, OPA there were, wait a minute, it's one fish. How can you have different fish? Well, it is scary, but there are a bunch of them.
They're different. Yeah. OPA has its own subfamily, or maybe even its own family. I'm not a taxonomist. I need to look that up. But John Hyde, who's in Southwest Fishery Science Center, you know, it was just amazing talking to him back in October about OPA. You know, there's five different species. A lot of them have different shapes in the head and colorations. The ones we have in Hawaii, the two subspecies we have in Hawaii, are the most gorgeous ones.
You know, a lot of people tell you, and I've done this with countless people at the auction, is how do they swim? I mean, it doesn't look, this thing called the OPA doesn't look like a fish.
It's not athletic looking.
It's not athletic looking at all. It's not sleek. It's not like your Ono that goes slicing through the water, like the Mai Mai that leaps over tall buildings. This is a big slug.
Yeah, and I've heard talking to fishermen that they put up a fight for about 30 seconds.
Exactly.
And then it's like reeling in a bucket, you know?
Well, you know what? It's been compared to halibut. You know, that halibut.
The doormat.
Yeah, the doormat. That they have, they come in like dead weight. The only time they get nervous is when they see the boat. Then they go nuts.
Yeah, I've heard about OPA too. Yeah. And the thing about OPA is they have different types. Well, OPA are quasi-warm-blooded. Mm-hmm. Which is fascinating. They have heaters, so they, due to their capillary system, they can go down deep. And they can stay at the upper pelagic environment. They're just really biologically an enigma, very, very fascinating. I recommend anybody, you know, reading about them. Yeah. There's also a book called American Seafood that was out about a year or two ago.
Remember this, American Seafood.
Yeah, I bought it from my mom for Mother's Day last year. And they talk.
And she's saying, "Perfect son, he brings me a book about fish."
Yeah, and she's listening. Yeah, she's probably listening right now.
Hi, mom.
Yeah, hey, mom. Yeah. OPA is an interesting fish, and there's different types of loins of OPA. Yeah, so you actually have three different types of meat. A lot of people think the yield is just in the belly area and the sides, but John Hyde was telling me back in October that you're utilizing the really tough tissue along the dorsal spine, around the dorsal part of the fish, and it's got a beef-like consistency.
Yeah, it is very, very dense.
And they're making steaks out of it able to utilize more of the fish.
Let me ask you this, because this always comes up. Because they look so ungainly and so ungraceful, what do they eat? How do they catch their food?
They eat a lot of stuff, and that's another interesting thing, is we don't know the diets of all, because so you maybe have different ecological niche, or we should say what they eat and how they behave along the five OPA. But they eat small fish, small pelagics, small squids. Mm-hmm. They're capable of going down deep.
I was going to say, because of their structure and their bladders, and you see those big eyes, you know they can get down there.
Oh, yeah.
So and they just look like a fish that would be happier standing on its nose on the bottom sniffing stuff out of the sand.
Yeah.
You know, because they just don't look like they can go very fast.
No. You know? I think they're fascinating. It'd be interesting to look at the reproductive output. And I know, so a lot of people in the Southwest Fishery Science Center, because they get a lot out in California too.
Yeah,
they're getting a lot of OPA. In fact, I was reading one of the recreational boat, a small boat fisher reports down in, I think it was Mexico or Guatemala. They were catching them down there too, which is kind of bizarre. A little warm to be down there.
Well, I can tell you, a friend of mine off Hilo, was fishing. He's a charter captain, and they had a strike, and they thought they'd hooked a log or something because it was just no pull. It was just boom, the rod went down.
Just dead weight.
It was an OPA. It was on the surface. You know, it took a lure. Well, I mean, you know, that's, look, it goes back to the thing, what used to be incidental or bycatch or maybe even unwanted, we found markets for. That those fish that you mentioned are a good example, OPA and Munchong. It certainly must lead to the discussion is, all right, the demand on this stuff, like you're talking aquaculture, is bigger and bigger. Are we spending enough research in our country or other spending enough research to really find out how to maximize the potential of growing fish and minimize the negative effect that it may have on the environment?
You know, and that's a good question. And that's sort of the $1 million or billion or multi-billion dollar question right now. Because, you know, there's many different aspects in aquaculture, the big two, one of which is the environmental cost. You know, you need to, in order to feed
fish.
What
do you feed them, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah. So that can come up. So within how much land-based resources and other aquatic resources are we going to allocate per pound of flesh for a pound of farm-raised fish? Mm. And that's a major issue. I mean, there used to be the Q10 rule. So 10 pounds of feed to yield 1 pound of flesh. That's kind of a ubiquitous number for land.
Which seems like a lot.
It seems like a lot, but they've been able to do a 2-to-1, 3-to-1 in certain some aquaculture fisheries. Yeah. There is a big push now for also for the cleanliness, but also the economic yield, because you don't want to spend a lot of money for something that the consumer is going to just snub their nose at. And that's the thing that, with my opinion, looking at tilapia, which is interesting, is they're easy to raise. I don't think they taste all that great, but they're kind of easy to deal with.
They're developing some sauces really quickly.
Yeah.
And a bunch of different names.
Right, you know, different names.
This sunfish, all these different things.
Right, and the other thing is shrimp. And I actually was on the phone, or was in San Diego a couple weeks ago. A really close friend of mine, Steve Sutton, who's opening an aquaculture facility in Long Beach, California, this year. Mm-hmm. And so he's using the opportunity to raise shrimp, so prawns, and it's targeted towards the growing Asian community in Southern California.
Sure.
So it's sort of in his spin is there is a culinary, there is an educational, and there's a recreational component. And so his business model, which is fantastic, and I can't wait till it opens, is people pay to fish for shrimp with hook and line and bait.
That's wonderful.
Which
what
is
an
really
idea.
Neat. Yeah, yeah. And they can have drinks
and catch.
And they have a chef that prepares it.
Yeah.
And then they also talk about how they raise the shrimp. And so they minimize. And so his goal is to minimize the environmental footprint to the point that he was telling me the amount of waste they're producing is just minimal. It's less than most restaurants.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, and I'm glad you brought that up because we could spend a minute on this as well. There's always a concern about, okay, where's that stuff coming from? And there are shrimp particularly, and other, you know, lobsters and shrimp and crabs and a lot of things that are grown in areas that are pretty sketchy as to where they are. So maybe even getting the reputation, your friend, what he's doing, it's going to come. This is the environment that these things are raised and caught in.
Yeah.
Pretty healthy.
And healthy, it's safe, it's sanitary.
Yeah.
You also look at the other issues, you know, a lot of, and here in the United States, and that's why I'm really a big proponent of U.S. seafood, whether it's aquaculture, whether it's wild caught, because the product has integrity in the United States for the most part. The use of antibiotics, the presence of bacteria, the handling of the product, the processing, you know, there's a lot of health risks sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you've probably heard about stuff coming over from Southeast Asia and from China that people getting sick.
Well, we had a huge outbreak of that not too long ago. But, you know, here's another thing. It's pretty interesting. You said something a while ago. So many people have asked me this. And we often talk about, like, tailpipe tuna and all of that stuff. But there's also a big concern of that almost everybody that I know, because of the price difference between a pound of farm fresh, I mean farm salmon and ocean salmon is huge. Mm-hmm. And what they're saying is that people would not buy the farm fresh salmon if it wasn't colorized, because it doesn't look like salmon.
Right.
So why is that?
Well, that's just a consumer issue. There's also, it could also be, in with the salmon, another issue is looking at the ratios of your omega fatty acids. Mm-hmm. You have different types of omega acids that have a very good nutritional and health benefit from eating fish, particularly salmon, that farm-raised salmon, based on their diet, doesn't necessarily produce those kind of, and then also with the coloration. So I think people correlate the two, and they may be a little reticent to get farm-raised salmon.
Because it's like gray.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like brown or gray.
It's an interesting color.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's still, I like the taste. I like the flavor. Yeah. But, you know, but salmon's caught a lot of flack lately. And I don't really, you know, I need to educate myself and get up to speed. But recently there's been some major concerns of health and environmental health and some salmon farming.
Yeah. And by the way, my friends, even though that's far, far away, people that eat salmon here think it's farmed here. It's not.
No.
It's cold water fish. I mean, it just can't. But there is an opportunity down the road. And I'm sure some of these things like the stock assessments and others are going to guide the industry into areas of experimenting on how to do more aquaculture of whatever it is.
Yeah. And you know, so there's a little bit of, you know, what we do in stock assessment is looking just at wild caught animals. But if you have a stock in decline, there is usually induces and invokes a desire and actually a business opportunity. And that's what people realize is like oftentimes, you know, these, when you have issues, business opportunities arise.
Yeah.
And so folks have been looking at open ocean aquaculture, ways to make it more efficient, and for tunas, small tunas, and other pelagics, which seems so far-fetched.
Yeah, but I've seen some amazing renderings and drawings and diagrams of the possibility of making certain pens and having them underwater so they don't get run over. All kinds of really neat things. Okay, before we run out of time, let's go back to this new project, which is a stock assessment and an abundance project. Where is that going to be?
So we're looking at our area is the central North and central Pacific.
Okay.
For, you know, Opa, Manchong, mahi-mahi, Ono. And then I'm working with Bill on, you know, one of the interests I have, because I like spearfish.
You love spearfish.
I love spearfish. So I'm trying to work with some of our international partners to look at, to see what kind of stock range we have. Are these spearfish our fish? And also looking at the other species, determining, well, so what is our relative abundance through time? Should we be of concern? And so what this should do, if based on our findings, it may invoke maybe more research or management action. You know, and there could be some concern with Manchong. I mean, Manchong, they're a deeper water fish. We don't really know a lot about them. So when you don't know a lot about something,
you don't want to keep taking them.
You need to be very careful.
What? But by the same token, ask the same question. What do they eat? More importantly, what eats them?
Pardon?
You know, what do they eat? And more importantly, what eats them? Where are they in the food chain?
Yeah, that's another thing that's kind of unknown. There's been some diet studies finding that they also eat, you know, these small deep water pelagics and Manchong. So there's two species of Manchong. There's the sickle. Of the sickle pomfrets. There is the lustrous Manchong, and then there, which is the seamount associated.
Yeah, that's the one with the longer dingle dangle.
Right,
yeah.
And those things are and those things, they yield a little bit more flesh, and so they're more targeted. And then there is the big scale Manchong, which is the more common one.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have different diets, and they may have different depth distributions. So research is probably going to be warranted on those. The one thing that Bill and I are working hard on looking at and maybe exploring is we know we have two species of them, and in the catch records, the pomfrets have been kind of lumped together.
Yeah, let's be able to somehow differentiate for science what we're catching. Right?
And so we need to tease out statistically the difference, that maybe there may be some sort of signal between the two that we need to come out with.
I think a lot of that's fascinating, because I don't think most of us know. That's why I keep telling you to go to wpcouncil.org and see some of the things that are going on, because all these projects that Mark and others are involved in, the net result is usually a paper or a rendering or a decision, which people are waiting for. I mean, you got hungry birds. Every time you guys do one of these things, all of a sudden now there's hungry birds in the nest waiting for the results.
Yeah, and we've been kind of coy about this project, you know, and working with Bill. We're just about midway through. We're going to be completed with this project in June. And I'm really excited, and I'm really happy to work with Bill. Bill's retired, but he wants to be working on this stuff. And you talk about a guy who knows more than anybody about the observer data set and the logbook data.
You got to tell Bill, you know, it's like the Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave.
I don't think he minds it, though. He's got a wealth of knowledge that really needs to be utilized.
It's so good that he is willing to share it.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Mark Finch, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
See you again next time. And for the rest of you, go to WPCouncil.org and find out the fruits of the labor. And by the way, in the same token, if you want to hear something on this or any segment of the Go Fish program, drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. Have a great weekend. Watch out, you know, it's going to be awful windy out there for some. Stay at home. Go buy some munchong. And take it home and fry it on up, all right? Have a great time. See you next time. Aloha.